Welcome, everyone. This is the LaRouche Show, May 20th, 2006. My name is Marcia Mary Baker, and I will be the host today with a number of guests, actually right now from in-studio near Washington, D.C., from near Cleveland, Ohio, from Montreal, just returned from Ontario. And the reason I say that, I'll be introducing people, is these people are gathered here on the topic, on with a specific discussion agenda of saying where things stand regarding the do-or-die effort to get introduced emergency economic legislation in the United States Congress to intervene to rescue the threatened auto machine tool sector and preserve and expand the very industrial existence of the United States. Just in the last 5 days has been released a special LaRouche Political Action Committee draft towards this legislation called the U.S. Economic Recovery Act of 2006. That's going out in mass numbers. In addition to that, I want everyone to know right up front that by the time of the next international interactive webcast by Mr. LaRouche, with which the LaRouche Political Action Committee has scheduled for June 9th at 1 o'clock, by then we want to know that this legislation has been introduced and we're going to make sure that it gets passed. Now, there's more to be said on where things stand right now about this, which our guests will do. So what I'd like to do is turn to introduce them. But remember, to everyone listening, you can get this pamphlet, it's about 26 pages, right off the website of the LaRouche Political Action Committee, www.larouchepac.com. And also, I want to point out that he has just written a new paper on the which is a kind of strategic evaluation of the crisis situation we're in now. In its title is The Cities of the Plains, which is, I believe, a biblical reference. I'll turn that over to one of our guests in just a moment. And that appears in the next issue of Executive Intelligence Review, and that will be the cover date, May 26, but you can get it online within a few days. And so this gives you an idea of the scope, the urgency, what we're doing. We're continuing our discussion today that we did a week ago on this mobilization. And so let me introduce the guests, and you'll see why they've assembled here from where they're located and what they've been up to in the last 10 days. I have right here in the studio three people. Paul Gallagher from Executive Intelligence Review. Welcome, Paul.
Hi, Marcia.
And I have from our newly established LaRouche Youth Movement Operations War Room on all of this, I have Sharon Stevens. Welcome, Sharon.
Hello, Marcia.
And Sharon, who has been most recently with the LaRouche Youth Movement in Detroit. In fact, that is where she is based. But she's been here on an hour-by-hour basis, especially regarding the upper Midwest auto states, the concentration of auto in Ohio and Michigan and across the river in Ontario, not to mention Indiana and places nearby. And also in this operations war room of the LaRouche Youth Movement, welcome Dave Nance.
Thank you for having me.
And you, I know, in recent times, in months, have been in Washington, D.C. anyway.
Right.
Okay. Now, also joining us, speaking of where the activity has been very hot in the last few days, we have Rob Ainsworth from Montreal, you've been down in Ontario. Are you with us, Rob?
Hi, Marcia.
Good. Very good, and we'll hear from him. And Joe Smalley is calling in for a few minutes right from near Cleveland, Ohio. Joe, are you still on?
Yes, hello.
Well, let's go right to it. Paul, do you want to say what kind of operation, speaking of the war room and these on-the-ground operations around the country, are underway? And then maybe we can turn to Joe while he still has time.
Yeah, I'd like to do that just to give a context of what we're doing. We've had, in the 2 weeks of this full mobilization, we've had a lot of meetings in congressional offices, a lot of meetings with members, a lot of meetings with their staffs. There is a great deal of interest and circulation of LaRouche's legislative outline. it's being called a very bold proposal, a very great leap, a very big step for them to take. There's a great deal of interest, but in terms of introducing this thing, there is not that. We haven't reached that point. Somebody introducing it, other people backing it, beginning to roll, we're not at that point. And this is because it's an anti-globalization move, fundamentally reversing free trade policies and fundamentally restoring the principle of incentivizing and building up the machine tool and the industrial base of the country. It's been a long time since we did that, and we have to really push these people to change their axioms. So here's what we're doing. We are contacting primarily out of here, but also with the help of people in our regional offices, Democratic County Chairman of every county in the United States. We've already talked to nearly 1,000 county chairmen and other members of their other leaders of their organizations in those counties. We are mobilizing many, many of them to put pressure on Congress and on their Democratic candidates around this legislative outline. We've begun to circulate the first 300,000 of the pamphlet form of the legislative outline by LaRouche and the rundown of the 70 shutdown auto plants being shut down and the other unused capacity that has to be retooled for infrastructure production. We have, at the same time, we're activating many, many state legislators who have been followers of LaRouche's literature and have collaborated with us in the past to put pressure on Congress. We're doing that from here. We're also speaking to unionists in literally hundreds of locals of auto and other locals around the country in order to bring them into this mobilization. In addition, we've established a war room here in the National Center to make sure that all of this gets coordinated very rapidly, almost in real time, and an evolving group of 4 to 5 people from the LaRouche Youth Movement who have been out in the mobilization organizing are coming in here, and they are acting as the war room coordinators who make sure that the every possible pressure point, every possible targeting and activation of people to pressure Congress on this, which appears anywhere in the country, can be moved on, that it can be brought together with other collaborators, and that we know on an hour-to-hour basis all the time how the pamphlets are going out, how the many, many plants that we're hitting, the workforces are reacting, how the meetings with state legislators around the country are turning out, and therefore in the congressional meetings we are able to look them in the eye and say, we have a pressure on you already. It's nothing compared to the pressure we're going to put on you in the upcoming 3 to 4 weeks or so to get this legislation in, because that's what's necessary at this point. As I said, they see it as a brilliant initiative that Lynn LaRouche has come up with, combining the infrastructure deficit crisis with the auto crisis and solving them both. But it's a very, very bold step. They have to be really pushed to do it. So that's where how we've been approaching this whole thing.
Good. Well, let me ask or point out one thing right here, because you said there is a big call up of Democratic County Chairman, but the issue of the existence of our nation and industrialization is certainly bipartisan. But an associate of LaRouche was saying a couple hours ago, what all this amounts to is saving the Democratic Party from itself sometimes, because many will be in support of this kind of thing, but then they'll, speaking of axioms and changing axioms, they'll all go herding off in a crazy direction. And one of those right now, everyone listening I'm sure would agree, is energy. And there's some breaking developments on that. If you would just summarize, and then Joe Smalley has a report from Ohio.
It's a big distraction to getting this action taken by Congress. It has to be taken to save the nation's industrial capacity and the workforce in this sector. Big distraction is the Democratic Party's unfortunate energy policy, which focuses on the equivalent of the moonbeams that in Jonathan Swift's book, Gulliver's Travels, these learned scientists were making these moonbeams out of cucumbers.
Here, moonshine, we know that, but that's all right.
Yeah, here we have making gasoline out of corn, which takes more BTUs of energy to put into the process which produces the ethanol than the same gallon of ethanol can produce when it's burned. It's an energy loser on every single gallon that's produced. In order to make any significant dent in auto fuel supplies, auto fuel use with ethanol, you'd have to cover 10 to 15% of the land area of the United States with corn, and that would be just to begin to make a dent. It is an absurdity and a complete distraction, along with the other wind energy and so forth, from the real return to FDR's policies of the construction of the United States as the greatest economic and industrial power in the world, which is what we have to be dealing with here. So we're taking that on in EIR and in the pamphlet as it keeps rolling out. We're going to stop that ethanol nonsense, nip it in the bud, because it's just a waste of their time when they have to be taking action of this kind. As the pamphlets come out, there will be millions of these pamphlets circulating and many, many interventions that we will be able to make in the Democratic Party and with its members of Congress while they're in town meetings and so forth, and just show the absolute absurdity of this.
Well, illustrating what you say, Senator Harry Reid, the minority leader of the Senate, is in Ohio right now, and our LaRouche Youth Movement leader, Joe Smalley, has been there with a group. Joe, if you're there, please, what happened? What's up at this event that you attended?
Well, we just came from it, and we came from Dayton yesterday, and this morning decided to, I think, to make some signs to ridicule this. As Paul was saying, it's something that, you know, we discussed immediately needs to just be thrown off the table of options. And so what we did, we made some signs, which I think are pretty funny, illustrate sort of what we were going at, what we were leading with. And there was sort of no hesitation in the way we organized, just there was a press conference that Reid and Sherrod Brown, who's running for the U.S. Senate, he's currently a congressman, and the two of them gave this, it was supposed to be on ethanol. So what we did, you know, with these signs, which I'll just give you a couple of examples. One titled The Great Ethanol Swindle of 2006, with a picture of the United States and half of it, they cut in half with corn on the one side and no corn on the other, demonstrating that you're going to need to convert half the land to a corn production to make this feasible, which in itself, you would need to do that, you would need power sources, you know, other than ethanol to convert that amount of land. But, and also a drawing of a man operating a asshole-powered automobile, which got some laughs. These signs were, you know, there were news stations, CBS News was taking photographs of these. but what the general response, you know, we just sort of walked right into the press conference, was outside, and almost, I think, everyone there, of the responses, there were, is myself, three others, myself, organizers, and everybody had similar responses that no one at this event was actually seriously was seriously supporting ethanol. Considerable agreement that we had with people that ethanol was not an end and all, and that you can't actually run an economy off of corn. And that was relatively significant. Another organizer, Joel, he actually spoke with Sherrod Brown, who actually admitted, yeah, I know all this stuff. I know you can't sustain an economy with this ethanol, that it takes more to produce it than you actually get out of it in terms of BTUs. He knew this, but it's funny because similarly, everyone there, while everyone knew ethanol wasn't a solution, everybody was sure to be very afraid of nuclear power. So that was something that we tried to push, and all of our signs, you know, saying something along those lines, organizing people around that. You know, how do you actually have a high-speed rail system? It's going to require lots amounts of electricity, going to a maglev, these types of things, these transportation proposals that Harry Reid was talking about. That's going to require an investment in nuclear power, and people were not really willing to talk about that. There's just very immediate, says, no, I'm not going to address this. So I think our position there, our presence, was very important in that respect that, you know, Democrats, they know they're going to have to take up this question sooner or later.
Joe, can you stay on a minute? Because Sharon Stevens, who's here with us, who's been in the war room and back and forth, she's based in Detroit, as you well know. I don't know if she has any more questions for you or things you want to bring out, because people should know there's been a whole week of action, correct, in Ohio.
Yeah, we had a week of action in Detroit prior, and the most significant action has been in Ohio this last week, where through the course of the week we had set up meetings with state senators, state representatives, but gaining as many meetings as possible to discuss the LaRouche's emergency legislation. And here where you have, you know, a reform going back to solar power, wind power, chicken manure power, whatever other power.
Marijuana power there, I think.
Maybe for some. But our ability to go into the State House and engage rather than on any of these single issues has been to conceptualize rather the optimism that lies within taking the unused capacity in these idled plants or these plants that have been shut down and giving them, you know, a sort of an animation as to the transformation of the nation by retooling and utilizing these auto plants to rebuild the nation in, you know, the form of infrastructure development projects, whether it's, you know, nuclear power or high-speed rail. And in Ohio, the response has been very developed in terms of high-speed rail.
Joe, were you on some of those meetings, or you want to add while you have time to stay on?
One thing I think is important is that, as I think about the 15 of us from Detroit who came down here to Ohio, we all had the intention to work through the three papers that we have of Walter Reuther, and one on the issue of atomic energy, and then the other two related. One was written before World War II, the U.S. entry into World War II, where he was proposing and actually going through how, by what means, we're going to retool the automobile manufacturers to start producing airplanes and bombers. And then the other one written in 1945, after we had won the war in Europe but still fighting Japan, that addressed the reconversion, taking these plants that originally automobiles, now aerospace oriented, now we're going to take these plants and convert these to produce high-speed rail and low-cost housing on a mass production basis. Organizing, one interesting thing, you know, reading these throughout the traveling, because we've been traveling quite many distances from city to city, covering the whole state, and then immediately applying these ideas of Reuther's into the field and telling especially the workers at these auto plants, and some of them are the largest plants I've ever seen, the assembly plants, such as in Lordstown, in Warren County, or in out in Avon Lake outside of Cleveland. And what this is that the workers coming out of here, hearing the word Reuther, you know, they immediately have a sense that he's a leader. But then when we tell them that this guy actually had a plan over 50 years ago, to do what LaRouche is trying to do now, they sort, I mean, they say, no way, get out of here. You know, this, that's a genius idea. So there's a definite response, and I mean, just the power of those ideas is really, I think, something that cannot be emphasized enough. Is just that to know that this has been proposed, to know that the solution is being worked out in this type of way. That's what we've been organizing around. I was not in any meetings. Other people covered that, mostly in the state house. But there was some interesting things where, I was in Lorain, the city outside, about 30 miles west of Cleveland, and we came across a retired UAW members meeting, which was in the state representative district of a man named Kazira, who the limb who was in Columbus had just met with an hour beforehand. And this was, I mean, this is an example of sort of the cross-firing where we have a meeting and then immediately penetrate into the population. It's, you know, the effects of that, you know, will play out as we follow up on these contacts that we made. But there are about 200 people at this meeting, while the plant across the street has been shut down to something we didn't know about until we got there. But then, I mean, with continued organizing around this and spreading of the relationship of Ruther, Roosevelt, and LaRouche, I think will be important in the upcoming periods. We'll probably do more of this type of work back in Michigan.
Well, let's turn a minute to Dave Nance is here, and you have all kinds of you have an overview maybe of the whole country, while Ohio was one of absolutely the focuses of our week of action. But this kind of description of real-time turnaround, that's what we're going for.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. What we've it's part of the war room experiment where, you know, we're getting a lot of activity and reports from all over the country, from people who are involved in making interventions at the local, state, and federal level. I've been doing more work on the question of Washington, D.C., and the intersection of the work going on in the Midwest with the work we're doing in Capitol Hill and, you know, calling, emailing, faxing, setting up meetings, and so forth. And what we found in D.C. is a general openness to the legislation. We've had a lot of meetings up on the Hill, a lot of them with people directly affected by the auto crisis, but also meetings with other people who you would expect perhaps not to be as provoked by the current crisis. You know, people who indirectly are affected by the implications of this or simply wish for a turnaround in the country as a whole. I mean, in general, it's been very good. Obviously, we have to step up the mobilization, and one of the things that we're going to be working on in D.C. Is increasing the circulation of Lynn's Emergency Act of 2006, as well as working on getting people more of an education on science, which, from all the reports I've gotten, has been one of the major difficulties we've had with staffers on the Hill, which is the fact that they understand very little about real science, whether it's, you know, what we're seeing occurring around the question of ethanol or fart power, or, you know, what is currently going on in terms of people lacking a real understanding of the machine tool design principle. So that's something we're going to be working on in terms of taking this message out to the streets and taking it up on the Hill. That's part of the picture here.
Thanks. Do you want to add on Capitol Hill, Paul?
No, I think we've given the picture. As I said, we've had a lot of meetings, and we're going to have a lot more in the next 2 weeks. But the differences being made, some are much more serious in the recent days than they have been before, and that's because they're getting the message that there's going to be pressure on them. We're going to be at state Democratic conventions and in other ways putting pressure on them. It's interesting to notice that the Democratic Party has actually pushed on the question of gasoline and the price of gasoline and oil and the refinery shortages in the United States, done something very surprising, which no one would have said they would have done a year ago. They are pushing for the in a bill going through the Energy Committee of the House now, they're pushing for the government to build and operate a series of oil refineries and provide refined products to the military with government-owned refineries, and in periods of fuel price crisis, to sell the products of the government-owned refineries to the private sector in order to regulate the price. So this is certainly a tremendous departure from free trade, and they would never have done it in any field a year ago. They're doing it now because of the pressure of the run-up in gas prices. This is a step in the direction of the creation of a public corporation to take over unutilized space in the capacity in auto and use it for infrastructure. So we have that definite precedent established by the action that's being taken right now on energy.
Well, while you were speaking, too, Dave and Paul, both on this matter of science, not myth or cowardice or whatever other things are going, a New Hampshire emailer has sent in a particular item about, it appeared on ABC 2020 recently, I think May 12th, that instead of the thought that radiation is dangerous for you in low doses, it's very life-enhancing, so that Paul, do you think maybe this is the occasional kind of shift you see in some of the coverage?
Yeah, it's very interesting. This is something that our Fusion magazine has covered quite a lot, and 21st Century Science and Technology magazine in the last 10 years has covered quite a lot. This what they call hormesis, the beneficial effect on living things of low-level radiation as opposed to no radiation at all. And there's a great deal of evidence, scientific evidence, for it, which it's definitely a shift and an interesting one that this would be on ABC.
Well, one thing, unless Joe wants to pipe up, he's speaking to us from Cleveland, Joe Smalley, in northern Ohio, with some other question. What I'd like to do before the half-hour mark, and thank you for the emails, we'll keep getting to them, is that... to get a short report from Ontario, because there's been on-the-ground organizing in and around the auto plants, just the way Joe was describing in the week of action in Ohio. Rob, do you want to throw in something right now on that?
Yeah, sure. We just went down to Ontario. We've been working with the CAW for about 4 or 5 months now.
That's the Canadian Auto Workers, right?
Yeah, the Canadian Auto Workers. And right now we have several plants that are threatened with closure, in particular a plant in Oshawa, which is apparently one of the most productive facilities in North America. And now we've been meeting with CAW officials. We're also organizing a candidate right now who's running for the leadership of the union later this is an election year for the union. And so this is all building up towards mid-August, when these elections will take place out in Vancouver. And as we discuss with these people, more and more things are opening up. You know, people who a few months ago might not have talked to us are now willing to sit down and really talk about Lynn's proposals. And we have a series of meetings next week that we set up through our organizing this past week with MPs in the government right now.
So you'll be up in Ottawa or elsewhere?
Well, these people are in the Kitchener-Waterloo area in southwestern Ontario. But yeah, this is for the federal government. Also with union officials out of the Oakville area, where there's a large Ford Motor Complex. These people are very, very interested in what we're doing. And the thing is right now that our government is trying to pass a free trade agreement with South Korea. And this is a major threat to the Canadian auto industry. So you have a campaign that's beginning right now amongst the CAW to fight this this free trade agreement. Now, when we speak with these people, we ask them, okay, well, you've got this fight that you're starting, but what do you do next? You know, where do you go if you defeat this free trade agreement? Where do you go next? And they have no answers, right? And but this is the thing that we have right now, and they're starting to realize this. The people we're talking to, and they're intrigued with this idea of infrastructure development. You know, and they agree that they can do these projects, right? They can build this stuff, but they haven't. There's a conceptual problem where they haven't been thinking in this way. Right, so they're opening up more and more. Now, the thing is, the context of this change that's occurring is really a massive assault upon our industrial economy. And what we also did, we met with the steel workers based out of Hamilton, Ontario. And the situation right now is that Canada has two major industrial firms or steel plants. You have Dofasco, which was recently bought up by Arcelor,
right,
and you have Stelco, which was recently in bankruptcy reorganization. Now, Stelco has recently been purchased, or a 20% controlling interest was purchased by a U.S. hedge fund. And now these guys are coming in, and they've brought in a fellow, and this is what I want to ask Paul about this. They brought in a fellow named Rodney Mott. We've nicknamed him Rodney Rott. And we're going to be organizing against this guy in the coming weeks. Well, this guy was running ISG, the conglomerate of U.S. steel companies, which was, I think, a couple years ago purchased by Mittal. Now, this guy is coming in, and the word we're getting from our union contacts and or amongst the steel workers is this guy is proposing slashing benefits, wages, pensions, but also, and something that really struck me, where they're talking about slashing capital investment by $70 million from 240 down to about 170 per year. So this union, what we it's really the timing was perfect, because as we went to this union meeting on Thursday, we realized that we had just stepped in to the first stages of a total war within the steel industry in Canada, and the union. These guys are ready to strike, and we anticipate a strike as early as August. That's what these guys are planning. So they're ready to move, and the proposal that we brought to them, the four of us that went, was to start working with the CAW and to bring in also the machine tool sector in Hamilton, because we also discovered on this week of action that there are approximately 160 machine tool shops in the Hamilton region. And that's not counting, then, of course, what we're going to have in Oshawa, Windsor, which we have about 10 auto plants or 12 auto plants in the Windsor region. So we're going to start to get a handle on the machine tool potential in Canada right now.
Rob, I just have to, at halftime, that is, about 3 minutes ago, I have to make some program announcements. And then we will throw this open again.
Okay.
So I'm sorry to interrupt, but that picture is ultra clear and stark on the contiguous industrial center of all of North America being at stake, and in turn the nations involved and so forth. So I need to say that this is the LaRouche Show. It's every Saturday. Today is May 20th, 2006, and we are from 3 to 4 p.m. in the afternoon Eastern Time out of near Washington, D.C., Leesburg, Virginia. Those of you participating now, and thank you for your emails, know we are on www.larouchepub.com, LaRouchePub.com. And I urge you to look on that site for the latest, especially what people are talking about here, all the aspects of this economic action now, emergency mobilization. But I, in particular, if you want to get material and arrange to confer by telephone, call this number, which is the EIR News Service, all during the week. It's 1-888-347-3258. That's 1-888-347-3258. So after that picture from Ohio and Ontario, David, you wanted to throw something in, I think, about what's at stake here, that has to do with what you've been doing in the war room, too, I'm sure.
Yeah. Yeah, I would just stress in terms of the fight around this question of obviously one part of the campaign is obviously to save the machine tool design capability that is tied up in the auto sector, which is very important because we don't want people to go out there and get into a state of mind where they assume that what we're doing is engaging in a campaign simply to save auto, which is not what we're doing. Our intention is to utilize the capacity that exists in the auto sector to begin to get, you know, the Congress of the United States moving to rebuild the entire country. And there are many projects out there which, you know, people can refer to in the Executive Intelligence Review. But it's really important that we make this as broad as possible in terms of conveying the fact that this is to be a first step in reversing 30 years of post-industrial thinking in the United States and reconverting our economy back to one which is concerned with, you know, science driver projects, great infrastructure projects, and ultimately exporting technology to the rest of the world at that level. So it's just something I wanted to throw in there just to sort of open up more discussion around, you know, sort of the positive side of this thing, because obviously there's a very dangerous aspect to this crisis around the financial crisis and various things Mr. LaRouche has been introducing. But there's also a very optimistic picture that begins to present itself once you get the full scope of what we can utilize this machine tool capability to produce and generate in this country.
So. Yeah.
On the question that Rob called in from Montreal, you're putting your finger on something which could directly tie together what the steel workers are going to do with us in Canada and what the auto and other workers have to face and are doing on this legislation here, because the ISG, International Steel Group, that you're talking about, that's got a tentacle in there now to try to wreck Stelco, that is Wilbur Ross. That's one of the bunch of hedge funds and conglomerate hedge fund operations run by Wilbur Ross, 25-year chief bankruptcy expert of Rothschild Inc. in New York. And Ross and that same group are also the partners of Steve Miller, the guy who was brought in to Delphi as the chief executive only last year and is now put in the bankruptcy court a proposal to completely wreck and disappear Delphi. 22 out of its 29 major plants closed down. 5,000 or 6,000 workers left in the United States out of 40,000. That's what he wants to do. So he's provoking a strike here, while Ross's other operation in Canada may be provoking a strike of the steel workers there. But in fact, you're dealing with the same locusts, the same financial locusts, in both cases, who just want to loot the money out of these corporations and put it into the bubble, put it into the commodities bubble or some part of Alan Greenspan's international bubble economy, taking it out of the investment in production, in machine tools, in infrastructure that has to be made. So you've got a real link there. We could discuss it in more detail on another occasion, but you've got a real potential link that those fellows can see between what we're doing here on the infrastructure and auto legislation and what they've got to do in Canada, both the steel workers and the auto workers up there.
Right. We definitely will schedule an upcoming show on, we can call it the financial entomology, the locusts. We can take them apart because it's true. It's the same gang.
I think we're going to have a little more discussion of this tomorrow night with Montreal, but off the air, obviously.
Okay, great. We still have remaining time, and Eugene has sent in an email. I'll get to that in a minute, but on nuclear power and so forth. But one thing, especially to Sharon and Dave in this, it's now a time of Democratic Party state conventions. We have in Texas where it's coming up, and our friend Keisha Rogers is running for office there in the Lim and campaigning like crazy. We have other states coming up. You may have a list. Indiana, I think. Massachusetts is coming up. There are Lim delegates. But so, again, what Dave said about on the positive side of how we should be rebuilding the country. Sharon, on the rejuvenation of the Democratic Party, do you have anything particular to say about that after what you've seen in Michigan or Ohio or at large?
Simply that the lack of leadership doesn't... none of the leadership comes from the Democratic Party in a lot of sense. And the primary factor has been to go after them around, obviously, holding Congress accountable and making sure that, you know, these policies are put forth to rebuild the nation, but also that we are the only force on the grounds and the only political organization that's able to recruit the population. And in the example of Keisha Rogers' campaign in Texas, the dialogue with the labor leaders, the simple farmers, but people who are generally concerned, you know, in recognizing the collapse of infrastructure being, you know, a reflection of the destruction of cities, you know, it brings to a higher level, you know, manufacturing and, you know, productive powers that are no longer going to exist if we lose machine tools.
I mean, I would just add to that if people want to get a real good picture of political power inside the Democratic Party, they should refer to the intervention of the LA Lim at the Democratic Party State Convention. And I think after witnessing anywhere between 150 to 200 young people engage in some real political organizing, they'll get a sense of the difference between the kind of leadership we're producing as opposed to what you're currently getting out of the Democratic Party. Obviously, we intend to upgrade the quality of thinking inside the party, but that's what I got to say.
And our war room operation, you know, gives us the ability to crossfire immediately. The responses of some of the, you know, as we hit the plant gates and distribute literature and recruit these people into a fight, you know, some of the feedback that they give us gives us a higher sense of the acceleration of the collapse of the economy. You know, where one woman who's working in a plant slated to be shut down, you know, just accounted for all the negligence in maintenance of her plant, from, you know, bathroom sinks falling apart to kitchen tables turning up missing. So
they're stripping the plant.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, just to note, in keeping with, you know, the these commodities prices and hyperinflation, you know, there are now auctions all over the place. And you can, you know, find websites. It's incredible that this is happening, where the selling off of these machine tools, you know, which are being bought up by international buyers, or, you know, because of the value of their metals, or
for scrap, even,
absolutely, is more valuable. And so, you know, once you lose this, you lose it all.
So this is the real urgency factor. I mean, that's the speed of the collapse, Paul. The commodities prices, hyperinflation, you know, all the rest of it. Paul, we have one. Eugene sent an email about, is there some particular place or cities where there is a support of nuclear power more than others? I just want to throw in here, the nation of Mexico itself announced the formation of a committee this week to make decisions on the future of nuclear power in that nation, picking up where they left off 30 years ago. But, and Paul, I think you're going to go down in June to collaborate on this mobilization, right?
I think maybe I'm going to go down by telephone wire, but
telephone
yes,
wire.
I'm definitely
going to
collaborate in that meeting that they have.
Okay,
there.
But is there anything live on nuclear power in Capitol Hill? Either one of you.
Nominally, there's a lack of real understanding. I would say I think you have people that do support it, but I think the general picture is that people don't have an adequate understanding of what it is. I mean, you know, you're talking about a culture on Capitol Hill where, you know, on any given day you'll see staffers walking around carrying the latest Harry Potter book or, you know, a picture, you know, Simpsons comics and things. So it's not the highest culture, at least among some of the kids there. So that's what I would say.
There's another part of Eugene's question. What cities are most of the activity taking place? You've heard a lot of them named already in the discussion and the reports that we've been having on this program this afternoon. We're doing this organizing in all the cities of the plain and the coast and the mountains, and we don't have offices and bases in every one of these cities, but we certainly go everywhere in the country. So I would say we have your email. Send us in a number where we can call you and coordinate activity and tell you what's going on, because it's a national mobilization. You've already heard about a lot of it. And the funny thing about the nuclear power is all the places in the United States that have nuclear power plants in the recent period have made it clear that they want more. There isn't much motion in Congress on this, as Dave indicated, but there are a few. And the interesting thing is that in the cities where nuclear power plants have been operating, now that they have the idea that maybe a few more are going to be licensed soon, they're all competing to get more, because it's by far the most efficient, cleanest form of energy that there is. And it keeps growing as a percentage of our electric power in the United States. Even though we don't build any plants for 20 years, they keep making them more and more efficient, so they keep carrying more and more of the burden of electric power in the country, the same plants. Now it's up to 25%, or almost 25%. So we're going to unleash a new wave of building of not just the boiling water and light water reactors, but the next generations of high temperature reactors, particularly cooled by gas rather than liquid, which can really produce not only very efficient power, but all kinds of process heat at a very high temperature and open up, for example, the production of hydrogen. If you really want to produce hydrogen, produce it with the high heats of gas-cooled high-temperature nuclear reactors. You can produce hydrogen from ammonia and other kind of base stocks, ship it like as propane is, and use it for a new generation of engines, not necessarily auto engines, but industrial power. But that's going to take nuclear power, as real industrial progress across the board is going to require. It's going to require the next generations through to fusion energy. We're going to unleash that with this.
Thank you very much. And let me just say, if anyone wants to throw in here, right now, this question of the capacity being on the brink. Sharon was describing how fast plants are stripped from people that are reporting into her who are organizing on the scene. And Paul, do you have you often get the centralized picture of, on the one hand, where workers say right now you could turn around and build a component for a nuclear plant, or how fast, what's the overall pattern in these many states in and around these 70 plants that have been identified?
Several of those plants in their own history have built parts for nuclear power plants, and in fact, several of them have fabricated fuel rods for nuclear power plants in the past. There's the one in Chrysler plant in St. Louis that has done that. That's been done at the Lockport plant, part of the Lockport complex in upstate New York, northwestern New York. These plants really are extraordinarily capable across the board. They could build the valves, the piping, as I said, fabricate the fuel rods, build electrical subcomponents, and a great deal of what goes into all but the central reactor units, a great deal of what goes into new nuclear power plants. But in terms of the stripping, you can find this, not only these plants closing down, but they're very rapidly being dismantled. There's a website that I was looking at today where an entire auto parts plant that just closed down in California is up for auction this coming Tuesday. You can either walk in there and buy the plant and scrap it, or you can buy it machine by machine, and it'll all be auctioned off. Just having closed down, it'll all be auctioned off on Tuesday afternoon. That's the rate at which these machine tools are disappearing.
Well, we have the we have 10 minutes remaining, and there's still time for the emails. But I also want, looking ahead, and we're not talking about the long term here. The long term is the next 10 days, right, before the Memorial Day weekend of Congress.
Yeah,
let's look at it
like
that's a long time. The LaRouche Youth Movement, right, is both organizing hour by hour, and you are recruiting in the process and planning still more. Sharon, you just had a cadre school in Detroit last week. Is that right, a recruiting?
Yes.
What is the perspective on this in general around the country? You have one coming up in Massachusetts, or what's the idea? Just to keep at it is to have more.
Yeah, that's the idea. There's you know, there's recruitment going on all over the country. I mean, locals in on the West Coast, in the Midwest, Boston, and so forth, are constantly recruiting youth. And, you know, the idea is to intervene in a big way at all of these Democratic conventions.
Right, of which there are many, right, taking place.
Mm-hmm. But second is that we're organizing around solutions and this question of leadership. You know, Lynn put out this FDR legacy pamphlet, you know, which was a preface for a platform for the Democratic Party, which, you know, is the problem, because they're not going out into the population and saying, we've got solutions and here are the measures which we have to take to, you know, improve the living conditions of people. And now with this emergency legislation, you know, it creates the foundations for them to really catalyze, you know, victory in November, not in an election in and of itself, but in that they can conceptualize, you know, their service to the general population, you know, as FDR exemplified in his recovery during the Great Depression, which allowed us to defeat fascism. And, you know, with people in his administration like Harry Hopkins and that massive mobilization to put people to work, the first 100 days, you know, was Roosevelt's platform for recovery. And the Democrats have to uphold something as great, because what we're facing is something bigger. So in terms of recruiting the youth, we're doing it. We're the only ones doing it. The young Democrats and the you know, political figures see that, and they're moved by that, because we are taking over the Democratic Party.
Great. And, I mean, that couldn't be more positive and rightly optimistic. So I'm going to ask a negative thing of Paul. Let me just is that what we're up against? I heard, Paul, you and others overturned a rock this week when you were confronted by all of this for ethanol, and found the same old cast of characters, George Shultz and others, who've been promoting this through a series of foundations. Is that right? It isn't just some nice ordinary Joe citizens stood by and got dumb. That happened. But there was
found a new hybrid.
Okay.
What this was supposed to have to do with automobiles and saving auto remained a mystery even after the three CEOs from auto came in.
That was
visited
yesterday,
with
2 days
Congress
ago?
A couple of days ago, and made a big deal about ethanol. What it was supposed to have to do with saving the capacity in the auto industry, they never said, and no one else asked them, and it wasn't clear. But in terms of the who's pushing this, we found a real interesting hybrid. The Set America Free, which is a kind of a website think tank sort of thing, which is pushing ethanol and biofuels very, very hard, is all the neocons. It's Daniel Pipes, it's Mayrov Wormser, it's Woolsey, the former head of the CIA. It's all these people who are straight out of the war rooms of planning regime change in the Middle East are out there promoting ethanol. Then you have, at the same time, this Apollo Energy Alliance, and that's Al Gore and George Soros-funded so-called progressive Democratic operations. And you have one side completely endorsing what the other side does. So then we found that the common father of both of these things was actually George Shultz, through who's, of course, the guy who created the Bush administration, and through Cheney named the members of the Bush administration. Shultz and his Rocky Mountain Institute for years. You have George Shultz and Amory Lovins, another interesting combination. In that Rocky Mountain Institute, they've been pushing the idea that if you want to confront the countries in the Middle East, confront the OPEC countries and the Middle East countries, the way to do it is with biofuels. And then you'll bring down those evil governments. So you see, it all does work out. And they push that out in both directions. And
left and right.
Also pushed it through the Committee on the Present Danger, which people remember has gone through several incarnations as a warmongering extreme right wing of the Republican Party. And that also is headed by George Shultz. And they also use that to push this idea that going back to cucumbers or ears of corn, earmarks we could call them, right?
Okay.
For our fuel, that's a way to attack our enemies in the Middle East. It's a lunatic policy, but we found it to be a very interesting hybrid. So we put that out in EIR, in the issue that's coming out this week.
Right. I'm going to make a pitch and stress again. We have three or four more minutes left today, which is May 20th, 2006. But do look for LaRouche's latest writings on, and especially this U.S. Economic Recovery Act of 2006. Look on the EIR News Service site, which is www.larouchepub.com. And certainly look on the Political Action Committee site, www.larouchepub.com. LaRouchePac.com, for this and for the June 9th webcast specifics. It's at 1 p.m. at that time. But now, again, Paul was hitting on the enemies who deliberately are doing this. I think George Shultz, I could just picture a tank and someone's putting kernels of corn off corn cobs in one end of it. That's supposed to be our national defense strategy?
I guess so, yeah.
Okay. But turning on the other side, as Dave and Sharon both emphasize, on the mission involved in this very tight deadline where we're going to get this emergency legislation, do you want to add anything more on the national picture, Dave?
Reiterating what I said before, I think we're getting a lot of good work done. In every part of the country, in Los Angeles, there are great reports coming in from the organizing, the Midwest similarly. In D.C., there's an increased density of activity. I think we just have to put more pressure on these guys.
Are you talking about getting out more copies on the streets of the capital city?
More copies,
is that what
absolutely.
You're planning?
More copies on the streets, more education on all these things we've been discussing. Nuclear power, which is not well understood by many in our generation at all. I mean, the 68ers sort of have a certain, you know, anti-technology complex to them, which is a major factor. You have the, you know, there's a certain kind of thinking inside the Beltway, which doesn't lend itself to thinking things in the Midwest are necessarily all that important. And you just, there's a lot of axioms that we have to break in the process of, you know, building, you know, a real force for change in this country. And, you know, a lot of work is going to have to come from the state legislators in terms of calling these congressional offices, making sure the phones are ringing off the hook. There's a lot more we have to get done. But, you know, thus far the picture is really, you know, is really optimistic. There's a lot of things which, you know, we're beginning to pull together. So, and that's the picture.
And Sharon, you had a week of action in Michigan, a week of action in Ohio, or is this the? I mean, are you? Do you have anything special to be designated, or you're going all out just the way that Dave said?
It is. It's going to be all out with the these different Democratic conventions that are coming up. Many opportunities are presenting themselves to intervene and provide a platform of ideas for the Democrats.
I heard one of them is to head them off on Memorial Day weekend, that Senator Harry Reid or somebody said they're going to try and have events for biomass power, and you're going to make sure we're going to head them off?
Well, we might head out to Indianapolis, where we'll cut them off at the Windy 500.
Okay. Oh, that's okay.
But again, just optimism. If you know, the idea is not to live in a corny society, right, or a corny-run society, but to have the creativity necessary of individuals who, one, are going to inspire others and lead, but second, within this machine tool design sector, which is, you know, where this high creative aspect of technological advancement occurs, is something that people have to really put themselves on the line.
Thank you. That closes it, and it clinches it, I'm sure. So thank you all. This has been May 20th, 2006, The LaRue Show. We're weekly from 3 to 4 every Saturday, and it's www.laruepub.com. And I thank Sharon and Paul and Dave and Rob, Joe Smalley. And next week we continue. That's May 27th. Thank you very much.
Thanks,
Marcia. Thank you.
Thank you.